let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or, if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. It is Scintillating Science Monday. I have a scintillating scientist for you. I'd like to welcome PhD candidate in developmental psychology at UC Berkeley, Colin Jacobs. Hello.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. Before we get started about your topic, which is fascinating to me, when did you first discover that you had an interest in the sciences?
I mean, ever since I was very little, I was very, very annoyingly a why question sort of kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I didn't even know this was a real career you could have until sort of later college when I was pestering professors, and they eventually were like, I don't know, you could do that research. And then it turns out that that's a real thing you can do.
So what kinds of questions did you pepper your professors with that they said, do research it?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really was class dependent, but I think that in general, when you're in a course that lets you engage with the actual reasons for why we believe something rather than just telling you the results, it does a really exciting thing where it prompts everyone to think like, oh, well, what if they did this instead? Would that change the results?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of questions sort of in that vein of things.
So you were approaching your professors, say, after a lecture, and you're like, well, what happens if they do this? And they'd say, no one studied that, so yeah. Is that how it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think it's so fun that psychology is such a new field, so we really don't know that much. So you can run up against the boundary of what we learn in lectures pretty quickly with just a few questions. And that was so exciting for me to learn that, like, oh, wow, someone doesn't know this, and it's completely answerable if we just change the experiment a little bit.
Now, would you say that this field of psychology, the types of questions you were asking, is this phenomenon sort of par for the course for the people who are studying psychology, that because it's relatively new, people are like, oh, no one knows this, oh, no one knows that, or are you kind of an outlier?
No, I don't think I'm an outlier. I think I see very similar intellectual curiosity in everyone I've gotten to work with. I think that's not even unique to just psychology. I think every PhD student or master's student, any sort of continued degree and person who like chooses to really dedicate themselves to understanding something shows this sort of like obnoxious inquiry of like, I want to figure this out sort of attitude.
So then how did you get into studying children?
That's a great question. I have always loved working with kids. So I was a summer camp counselor for quite a long time, like 3 or 4 years to make money in the summers. And then I was in child development in one of my psychology courses. And it was just so exciting to me to learn how knowledgeable little kids and even infants are. It's truly amazing that they seem to just be sitting there watching things often, but the processes that are going on in their mind behind the eyes are just absolutely incredible, and they're brilliant little minds.
So I in looking at the types of things that you study in children, you're studying how young children's moral intuitions and social cognition enable human cooperation. Break that down in simpler terms for our listening audience.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of jargon there. what I mean by that is that humans are very uniquely inclined to cooperate with one another, and that this is one of our biggest strengths as a species. So our lab, not myself, but our lab does a lot of comparative work where we say, how are humans unique compared to, let's say, chimpanzees or bonobos?
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things is that we're really uniquely cooperative with one another. And I'm really interested in what sort of forms that those sort of cooperation instincts have, or like how we are motivated to be cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of those things is morality. We have an intuition, a very unique intuition as far as we can tell,
mm-hmm.
For these moral norms, not just to like avoid harm, but to set standards within a social group or a cultural group of what is okay and cooperative and what is not okay and antisocial. And I find that a very, very interesting phenomenon, both just like as an individual and also as a researcher.
Okay. Are you on a speakerphone?
I'm not. Am I echoing? Because it's echoing on here. Let me take it off.
Okay.
I was on headphones. Was the sound bad?
Oh, much better, much better. Okay.
Okay, great.
All right, so you talk about cooperation. Don't we see cooperation with, like, ants? And don't we also see cooperation with, like, elephants and monkeys?
Totally. Totally, yeah. So a lot of different animals are cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
We are uniquely cooperative in the sense that we are more cooperative than most of our evolutionary ancestors. So maybe you could say that ants are just as cooperative. Honestly, I don't know much about ant cognition.
Mm-hmm.
But compared to, let's say, like chimpanzees, we have various ways in which we are uniquely helpful towards one another. We spontaneously try to share information is one example, whereas chimpanzees don't seem to do that. We are willing to sacrifice to meet a sort of joint commitment with another social partner in a way that chimpanzees aren't willing to do. They're more like, if I got mine, I'm out of here. We share to a greater extent than chimpanzees do. And this isn't my area of expertise is not what chimpanzees do. It's what the kids do.
Sure.
But to my knowledge, that's how we're different.
So then talk about children's moral intuitions. What
sure.
does that mean?
Yeah, so as early as infancy, within the first year or so, from all the research that we've done so far, infants have this intuitive preference for characters that help others achieve goals and dispreference for those that either harm or prevent others from achieving goals. So I see this as sort of an early starting point.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really cool paper on the early moral core that was written by a collection of moral researchers on this for infancy. Then that sort of develops and shapes their normative insistence on things a little bit later on. So we go from, oh, I prefer people who help others,
mm-hmm.
just intuitively on a very basic level,
mm-hmm.
to I think all people are supposed to do this, and it's wrong for anyone not to do this right around the age of 3 or so. So you see what's called this normative turn in development. So they go from, I prefer pro-social people, to it is right for all people to behave in this way. And we think that that's through this sort of scaffolding of interacting with others and then generalizing these preferences to a broader understanding of what people ought to do.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions. We'll start with
yeah.
how does one measure that? Like, how do you find that out mm-hmm. in an infant? And then also, how does that weigh against children's sort of natural tendency to, like that kind of selfishness? You know, maybe selfish is the wrong word, but, you know, kids yeah. don't really know how to share when they're young. So mm-hmm. how do you balance those two? So those are my first two questions.
Yeah, so I'll take the second one first, mm-hmm. because I think this is a question that comes up a lot. Whenever I present on children's sense of fairness, which is what a lot of my research is on, people are like, well, they're not very good at it. So, absolutely, you're right, they're not. But I think the interesting part is not that we're imperfect in our execution of immorality,
mm-hmm.
but that we have an intuition in the first place that drives us away from self-interest
okay.
is really special, right?
Okay.
So, like, if we have any part of us that's like, maybe it's not good to take everything for myself, even if my selfishness wins out. Those competing impulses are like really important to what we do every day.
Okay.
It's a disincentive, even if the kids aren't always listening to it.
Okay. And then how do you tell that they prefer help over other, you know, how do you measure that?
Yeah. So in infants, I'm actually really excited to learn more about how to conduct this kind of research next year with Dr. Brandon Wu and UC Santa Barbara. But just from an outside perspective, I'm not an infant researcher yet, but they use looking time and reaching measures primarily. So there's various ways in which infants look longer when they're either surprised or when they prefer things.
Okay.
So I'll just give you a small example. If you show an infant the same sort of situation over and over again, they get bored. I think we all would get bored. So they stop looking as long. They kind of start looking around the room and rather than looking at a display that you're showing them.
Okay.
If you then change something about that display and they recover attention, they start staring at it again. That means that they notice that that thing is different.
Okay.
Right? So they notice that something has changed in that. So if you showed them, for example, someone kind of behaving the same way each time, and then all of a sudden they split it resources unevenly between the two recipients, you could say, oh, they noticed that the even split was different than the uneven split. And there's all sorts of controls that researchers do in this sort of design to make sure that it's not just visual or perceptual. But yeah, that's the basic idea, that we can leverage what we know about the way that infants attend to different things to measure their sort of implicit expectations and evaluations. And then you can back that up with reaching paradigms too with a little bit older infants. So they'll reach for the character that they prefer if you bring them like a toy that looks like the character.
So then how do you go from them looking at something longer to them like having a moral imperative to appreciate the sharer over the non-sharer, or the fairness over the non-fairness?
Yeah, so that's a really, really good question. And I think that's we're running up against what we don't know 100%. It seems like children have a preference in the sense that they would rather look towards, let's say, a fair sharer. They also prefer to reach for that person. They also associate praise. So if you say, good job, they'll look towards that character rather than the other one.
Okay.
But whether or not that reflects an obligation, some sort of true, like, moral commitment, rather than just a preference, is a really interesting open question that people are arguing about right now in the field.
Yeah, because maybe they just respond to the dopamine release of praise as opposed to, you know, preferring it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so in I think I didn't do a great job explaining it. So if you say praise, and you put the unfair and a fair character on screen, they will selectively pay attention to the fair one. If you play admonishment, like, no, that was bad, they'll preferentially look instead towards an unfair agent. So they seem to be associating, like, okay, good stuff with the person who did the right thing and bad stuff with the person who did the bad thing.
Does
that answer your question then?
It does. So now tell me everything about this. Don't leave anything out. How, like, what are some of the things that in your studies you've run up against that you were like, I didn't even, that it blew your mind?
Yeah. I think my very first study was fairly surprising to me. Just because it has a fun counterintuitive result. I don't think it's like the most groundbreaking thing in the world, but we had run a distributional fairness paradigm. So kids get to accept or reject a certain offer of things. So let's say I'm splitting up candies between myself and you, and I give myself two and you two. You should be perfectly happy with that. if I give myself more than you, maybe you demonstrate some sort of objection, right? Like yes. you are willing, from the four-year-old's perspective, they're willing to throw it all away rather than let you get more than them.
Burn it to the ground. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen they're that. Like, no, not uh-huh. okay. Uh-huh. And the fun sort of counterintuitive result that we found is that you can make it a distribution of trash balls, of literally crumpled balls of garbage that they say, no, I don't want that.
Uh-huh.
And yet they're willing to sacrifice valuable objects that they do like in order to say, no, you can't get more trash balls than me. So the idea is that they're responding to this like interpersonal implication that mm-hmm. like, no, you're not more valuable than I am, rather than the actual material consequences.
And to that, I have a friend, like most of my friends who have children, they all will say, you know, children are very good at making sure that everything is exactly, precisely even. You know, like if you have a cookie, yeah. they will know if you break that cookie up, they will know exactly, like that person's getting more than me. So I kind of love that. I saw this study a long time ago where they took American kids and Mexican kids, and they had this thing where if they moved something across the board, then you could get a cookie if you got it mm-hmm. in one area in a certain amount of time, but only one of them would get a cookie. And the American kids just kept moving it back and forth, so neither of them got a cookie, whereas the Mexican kids would take turns helping the other person move it into the corner so that they could both each get a cookie. So to that, how does it get bred out of kids to be cooperative?
Yeah, that's a great question. I am not a parent yet, so I do not know how it I feel like that's a really like experience-focused question. I feel like everyone's going to have a very different experience. And we all learn to, unfortunately, tailor our moral sensibilities to what the world allows us to do, right? I think we come in as fairly righteous individuals when we start this sort of early moral development, and then you start to realize that the world isn't fair and that it's usually not possible to insist on fairness in every example. And so you sort of learn to tamp down or tailor that impulse. And what that looks like for everyone, I think, is a really complicated and interesting question, but difficult for me to answer with any confidence.
Okay.
I do think that one thing that you point to, which is really cool, is that there's a difference between cultures and how we tailor these moral impulses, right? There's a cool interaction between this early moral core that seems to be true for people across all societies and how that gets shaped by our cultural context and the social messaging we're getting into sort of moral intuitions later in life.
Okay. So I'm also looking, you say your work integrates cross-cultural methods and dyadic experiments. I don't even know what a dyadic experiment is. So if you could explain that and talk about the cross-cultural methods that you use.
Yeah, absolutely. I really should work on making myself a little less jargony. This is my first time talking outside of people in my little niche. So this is so helpful to understand what doesn't always translate. Dyadic is just two kids interacting with one another.
Oh, okay.
So most experiments are one kid sitting down, and we either show them something or present them with a situation and then evaluate their response. I'm really excited, although it's a bit of a pain in the butt practically, I'm really excited about studying how children interact with one another. So a lot of our studies, or at least a few of our studies that I've done, explore how they spontaneously cooperate with one another or how they respond to peers receiving differential treatment from them when they're across from one another. So it feels much more natural than a typical experiment where you just show them a situation or present them with something in a lab by themselves.
So give an example.
Yeah, sure. So in one study, we were interested in whether children objected to unfair belief. So we, I think as adults, it's really easy and intuitive to say, like, it's not okay to believe someone for the wrong reasons, right? So if you're just believing one person over another because of their identity, let's say they're a man, or because you just like them more than me, mm-hmm. that's not fair. You're disregarding me unfairly, right? Mm-hmm. And we sat kids down in a with a tube in between them, mm-hmm. and they both peek inside of the tube and they offer their testimony. So I see a flower, you see a tree. Mm-hmm. And it's rigged so that they disagree with one another. And then we have a third party listener sort of play the stooge and say, well, you said it was a flower. You said it was a tree. I think it must be a tree. Mm-hmm. So they align with one person over the other each time. And then we got to see this like really cool interactive reaction of the kids when that happens. So they both look at each other with surprise when they disagree with each other. Like, uh-huh. I didn't expect to say different stuff. And then often they would sort of protest against the listener. They'd be like, hey, what do you mean? Like, look at my side. That is really exciting to me to see these small, like, behavioral, natural responses rather than just asking them a scripted experimental question.
So in that situation, since the stooge agrees with one, does the one who gets agreed with ever revisit it and say, hey, you know, I don't know why this person saw this? Or do they just go like, well, they agreed with me and, you know, case closed?
Yeah, it's a good question. It depends slightly. Mm-hmm. So when you do just ask them, do you think that person was fair or unfair? Mm-hmm. It turns out that both the kid who's believed and the kid who's disbelieved evaluate the person as unfair.
Really?
Right.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I thought that was kind of surprising as well. They see the image in front of them. They see it's a tree. Mm-hmm. And then the listener agrees with them, and they still say that that person's unfair.
Wow.
So I was really excited by that. But they don't seem to protest. So in other studies, like these material distribution games where I give someone more cookies than the other person, mm-hmm. sometimes the kid who gets more cookies, when they're a little bit older, mm-hmm. They'll be like, no, I'd rather throw away all the cookies rather than me getting more. And we didn't see anything like self-sacrificing like that in our tube study necessarily.
So I saw this, I guess it was a TikTok challenge where they put cookies under a bowl and with a little kid in the middle and then the mom and the dad, and then they lift off the bowl and the kid's got two, the dad's got one, and the mom's got none. And the kid almost almost every kid, when they saw their mom didn't get one, gave their mom a cookie so that everybody could have one, which I just, and they were small kids. So is that what you're talking about in terms of being willing to me, that's sacrifice, because you had two cookies and two cookies are better than one, but you still give one away.
Yeah, so there's a couple different types of self-sacrifice. One is like sharing, which is a bit like that. Mm-hmm. Closely interrelated would be like rectifying inequalities, which is a very big topic in our area because it's a very pressing issue in everyday life. And then the other one is just this sort of ultimate denial, which is like, no, I'd rather throw away all the cookies than to accept me or you getting more. That's called the ultimatum game. And they also do that, at least U.S. Around the age of eight, children would rather throw away all of the reward than to accept getting more than their partner.
I just think that part is fascinating. So do these kids, does it change when they're siblings?
That's a good question. I don't know of research directly addressing that question.
Okay.
I assume that the relationship with the person could definitely have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
There's some research on friendship. So we know that this is cross-culturally variable. It changes between societies, but U.S. children think that it's somewhat reasonable to give your close friend more than a random person.
Okay.
So they do see that sort of informing it. I don't know of anything testing specifically like how siblings interact.
Okay. Now, do they think that this heightened cooperation has anything to do with like historically, like when you go back to these small tribes that needed to cooperate to survive, so only the ones that did cooperate could survive.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's two things. One is non-specific to fairness, which is pretty much exactly what you said, which is that there was some sort of evolutionary pressure in early human history that cooperation was uniquely important to human success. And they think that's where a lot of these sorts of impulses came from. That these hyper-social, hyper-cooperative environments were selected for, whereas the rest were sort of, died off. The second part to that is specific to fairness, which is really cool, which is essentially that if I insist on not being treated worse than you treat someone else or than you treat yourself, then we can make sure that any cooperative interaction is mutually beneficial to some extent. So they call this partner choice. There's very cool theories about it. I'm trying to think of how to best characterize that. Basically, if I get to choose between cooperating with you and another person, and I think there's some chance that you're not going to give me a fair cut of it, whereas I think other people will, then you're going to die out because you're going to find no cooperators because everyone's going to disprefer you. And therefore, over time, we select for sort of fair outcomes and fair behaviors.
So it's like it's the golden rule, or like it seems like every culture has that, you know, treat others the way you want to be treated, that sort of fairness doctrine baked into the cultures that have survived. So if you go forward, at what point does that impulse toward cooperation start to drop off, where you get people who feel like, or kids that will go on their own or be unfair?
I think that that's a good question. I don't know of research investigating when children start to be more unfair. In general, in experimental paradigms where you just put them in a lab setting and see what they do, children only get more similar to like adult morality over time. And that sort of is an unsatisfying answer because I know what you're getting at, which is like, well, it seems like we start to not listen to these moral impulses in everyday life. I don't think I have a great answer for why that happens, unfortunately.
I'll accept that. Well, then let me ask you this. You say that it differs over from culture to culture. Are there any cultures that have been studied and have been found to be more cooperative, and are there cultures that are extremely uncooperative in their dynamic?
I think that's a hard question because it depends on your perspective. I want to be really careful about concluding that something that let me start here, that the vast majority of scientific research reflects specifically Western, highly educated, very rich, democratic nations. We call it WEIRD as an acronym. WEIRD.
Okay.
Culture.
Okay.
And we, U.S. being one of them, are very unrepresentative of the world's intuitions in various cases.
Okay.
So I hesitate to say, like, when we bring our own understanding of morality into other places and they don't show similar responses, to say that that's less cooperative.
Oh, I'm not talking about that. When you talk about children and their desire for equitable distribution of resources, let's say. And that translates up the road to sort of a society where it stays there, that you need that equitable distribution of resources for the society to survive. Are there certain cultures that just have more of that?
Okay, sorry. I think I misunderstood what you were asking. Do you mind trying to clarify one more time?
Okay. So you talk about young children's moral intuition, and
yeah,
they favor people who focus on equitable distribution and
yeah,
helping people. So are there certain societies where that particular moral intuition sort of dominates versus a society where it kind of dies out?
Yeah, interesting. So you're asking more like in adult behavior at a like a large systems level.
Yeah.
Are there cultures which better reflect that sort of early intuition?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
I am not a political scientist.
Ah.
Unfortunately, I think that's out of my wheelhouse. I can tell you facts about how the kids in each society think about these things, and I can have my own personal values about which societies I think do this well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know of research that shows a link between the two.
Well, then let me ask a different question, which is, in your research, what has been when you've been observing things, what's an interaction that you observed that just made you so happy to be researching this, that you got to witness this?
Yeah. I think the little kids insisting upon a fair share of their trash balls was definitely one of them.
Okay.
That was quite fun. I also thought that it was very exciting. We've been running this project looking at how children sort of spontaneously collaborate on cognitive tasks,
mm-hmm,
in Kenya, China, and the U.S. And it's just been so exciting. I actually got to go to all these different sites to see these experiments run. And it was so exciting to see really similar and yet really different spontaneous moments of these two kids when we leave the room,
mm-hmm,
putting their heads together and being like, oh, I should do this and you should do this.
Ah.
Or they focus on the same thing together and start like, oh, repeat it with me. Okay, horse, dog, sheep, pig. Because we're trying to remember something.
And how old are they at that, in these experiments that you've been looking at?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
How old are these kids? Are we talking 3 years old, 8 years old? Like, wow, what's the age range?
Yeah, so 4 and 5 and 7 and 8. We have
an
older and a younger group in that particular experiment. But in general, I think the really interesting ages to me are from infancy to about like 7 or 8 years old.
Okay, so the experiment was like they have to remember something, and then the person leaves the room and the kids automatically just start trying to help each other remember?
Yeah, so they're supposed to remember all of the objects in front of them.
Uh-huh.
And we were curious what kind of spontaneous cooperative strategies would emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are working with another peer, and we found that in some cultures, like the U.S., they immediately go to like a divide and conquer method.
Mm-hmm.
So you do these ones, I'll do these ones.
Okay.
Whereas in these schools in somewhat rural Kenya. It's an area outside of Nanyuki, which is near Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more dedicated to like working together through every part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that might be related to sort of cultural ideas around what it means to work together on something.
Okay. But they immediately like look to each other. And in these experiments, is there any type of reward that the kids get if they remember, or is it just, hey, this is what you're going to do?
Yeah, so we definitely try to provide as tempting of incentives as possible. So stickers, in Kenya we use these little biscuits, cookies that they really enjoy at the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever a school is okay with us distributing and the children are happy to have, we try to incentivize it.
Okay. And then, so you've seen this in Kenya, you've seen the U.S., and you've seen it in China, and it's the same deal that, how do the Chinese handle it?
Yeah, so in Beijing, they looked very similar to the U.S. children, that they were very divide and conquer oriented from 4 and 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So we're thinking of it as this inductive bias, like the first thing that comes to mind when we say, oh, let's work together on this. Maybe in like very urbanized, independent, somewhat competitive cultural environments,
mm-hmm.
It's you do this, I do this. We have separate roles. It's very efficient. And then maybe in less urbanized, more rural environments where you have more close relationships with a bunch of others. People don't have quite of differentiated like jobs and roles in a particular setting. They're
mm-hmm.
more flexible.
Okay.
That might shape how young kids think about what it means to be like, okay, let's work together.
Okay. And then my last question for you is, what is the most adorable thing that any child you've ever heard a child say in the context of these experiments? To you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're listening to 89.5 FM.
I think probably so we didn't document this as a consistent effect,
mm-hmm.
but when we were running that tube study that I had mentioned, where mm-hmm. one kid is believed and the other one isn't,
mm-hmm.
the vast majority of kids, totally fine. It's just a game. We debrief. We handle everything. But there was one child who was pretty upset that we weren't believing his friends. And so he kind of came up to us after and was very shy because he was like 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up to me and he was like, I don't think it's okay that you weren't believing my friend. I think you really should go look at the tube on his side. And I obviously I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly what
right.
he said, but the very earnest insistence where he was feeling really bad on behalf of his friend who wasn't being believed
Aww.
In this situation was really, really sweet.
That melts my heart from, you know, and I'm hearing it like third hand. Oh, that's adorable. So if people wanted to find out more about the research that you do, what do you recommend for them? Is there a website or a book you think they should read or a podcast?
Gosh, yeah. This is my first time ever being public facing. So I don't have a specific website. You can go to Social Origins Lab at
mm-hmm.
Berkeley. That has our entire lab's research, and everyone here, I think, is doing really amazing work. Other than that, I don't have a website, so Google Scholar. If you've ever needed that, Google Scholar has any papers I've ever written on it. And yeah, those are the two venues. So Social Origins Lab at Berkeley.edu or the Google Scholar webpage.
All right. Well, Colin Jacobs, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. I could talk to you for hours, but unfortunately, I have to cut it short. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. People of Earth, kids have a moral compass. and it's awesome. So coming up next, we're going to talk about music, and I'm going to play a little bit of Nina Simone for you.
I'm gonna send you one by one, one for the little bitty baby was born, born in Bethlehem. Children, go where I send you, how shall I send you? I'm gonna send you two by two, two for Paul and Silas, one for the little bitty baby was born, born in Bethlehem. Four for the poor that stood at the door, three for the Hebrew children, two for Paul and Silas, one for the little bitty baby was born, born in Bethlehem. Children, go where I send you, how shall I send you? I'm gonna send you six by six, six for the six that couldn't get fixed, five for the gospel preacher, four for the poor that stood at the door, three for the Hebrew children, two for Paul and Silas, one for the little bitty baby was born, born in Bethlehem. The eight that stood at the gate, seven for the seven came down from heaven, six for the six that couldn't get fixed, five for the gospel preacher, four for the four that stood at the door, three for the Hebrew children, two for Paul and Silas, one for the little bitty baby, one for the little bitty baby, one for the little bitty baby. He was born,
Nina Simone, Children Go Where I Send You. That's from amazing Nina Simone. We love music. We're so lucky in San Francisco that we have so many musicians who give their time and their talent and they put it out in the world. One of those people is here to talk about a concert that's going to go on in the Golden Gate Park Band Shell. I'd like to welcome Eric Wayne. Hello.
Hello. Very nice to be here. Thank you.
So, Eric, tell me, what instrument do you play?
I play second trumpet in the Golden Gate Park Band.
Okay, now I am not in a band, so what's a second trumpet?
Well, see, in the park, a concert band is basically symphony without strings.
Okay.
Okay. We have what we call a desk. There are three of them.
Okay.
First trumpet desk, second trumpet desk, third trumpet desk. And the reason for that is because we do a lot of music stretching over 100 years.
Okay.
And some of that music calls for three cornets and two trumpets.
Okay.
So in the band, you'll see us grabbing different horns all the time.
Okay.
And on the second desk where I sit, there's nobody else doubling on that one. So I will frequently play third cornet or first cornet or one of the trumpet parts, depending on what the piece we're playing calls for.
So it's just a designation so you know which piece of music to pull?
That's correct.
Okay. So it's not like, well, this is the first one, so they're like...
No. Although, okay. I should say the first trumpet players in our band are... They're there for a reason. They're very good.
Uh-huh.
So Mark, Michelle.
Oh, okay.
There we go. A little shout out to the first trumpet chair. Yeah, third trumpet chair. Yeah, you guys, you know who you are.
So how long have you been with the Golden Gate Park Band?
Oh, wow. I started subbing in that band in 2000, something.
Okay.
Yes, I've been there quite a few years.
Now, when you started, how did you end up subbing? Were you a friend? They were like, oh, we need someone right away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the band has a very long season, 25 concerts every year.
Okay.
And it's a union band. So everybody in the band is in the musicians' union.
Oh, okay.
Everybody in the band is busy.
Okay.
Because they have other gigs.
All right.
And frequently they may have another job that pays a little better on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're there. So they call around to everybody they know and see who can sub for them in the band.
Okay.
And the band has been very traditionally for almost its entire – I mean, as long as I've – been involved within a sight reading band.
Mm.
There's no, unlike the symphony or the opera, we don't have like 2 weeks of rehearsal before a concert.
Wow.
We show up every day, every Sunday.
Uh-huh.
We show up at 11 o'clock and we read through what is going to be an hour and a half concert.
What?
But we only have an hour to look over the music. So clearly a lot of we're just going over, hey, this transition's tough. Let's play through that transition a couple times, that kind of thing. And then you just read the concert.
Okay. So I started taking piano lessons this year, and I'm the person who goes, every good – okay, that's a B.
Yeah.
So the fact that you – like how long did it take for you guys – how long does it take to get to the point where you can just read it, like where it's not just a bunch of dots on a page?
Right. It's, you know, it's practice. I mean, but this is a professional band.
Yeah.
All of the people in this band have been playing music and all kinds of music for a very, very long time. So you get to the point – where you're used to certain conventions, you can sight read a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
And the more, of course, the more years you put in the industry, the more, you know, the easier it becomes, and the more comfortable you are in that situation, because that is kind of a high stake situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
So you, as a trumpet player, you get there and they pull out some song you've never heard before in your life, and they just plop it in front of you, and everyone's like, "Okay, got it."
Pretty much. That's how it has been for a very long time. The band has changed because now we are an official 501c3 nonprofit, which. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to call Keith, our treasurer, and say, hey, did we just finish our fifth year as that or fourth year? So we're kind of new in the nonprofit idea.
Got it.
Right?
Okay.
And when I took – I'm also the librarian for the band.
Mm.
So when I took over that job, and boy, let me tell you, the next time you're in the library, I don't care who you are or what library you go to, you go up to the librarian and you say, I'm sorry. I thank you. And then you just say thank you, because you have no idea how much work that is.
I have librarians on every month.
I had no idea. And so all you librarians, thank you. I have more respect for you than you could ever know. But once I took over that, we started scanning most, like all the music I could possibly scan, mm-hmm. and putting it up just so the people who were going to play on Sunday might have a chance to look at it a little bit before
mm-hmm.
the read through, which has helped a lot. And we've been, I think people were asking for that for a long time, because that does, you know, especially in some of these old, you know, Holst tunes and, you know, some very hard, you know, very challenging works that we just like, we just play them.
Well, let's talk about the show that you're here to talk about.
Okay. Yes. Well, because we are a nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
This is our first year of ever having a fundraiser.
Ooh, okay.
Because that's where we are now. If any of you listening are just arrived into the United States, let me tell you, the Trump administration is not going to provide you with a lot of cash for your nonprofit arts groups,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're there in the same boat as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have the first ever fundraiser for the Golden Gate Park Band on October 12th at noon. We usually start at 1 o'clock on our usual concert calendar.
Uh-huh.
So we're just going to do it at noon.
Uh-huh.
The idea is that a few of us in the band, myself, Hal Richards, Renee, Dieter, Bob, and Robert from the rhythm section, a friend of mine who's going to play piano for us, we're going to play like an hour of some serious jump blues music so you can swing dance.
Oh, okay.
And then after that hour, it's a dessert potluck.
Ooh.
So you can work up an appetite to justify all that sugar that you're about to eat. and we're doing it – I mean, you know, we're doing it at noon. Let's be serious. We're trying to do this on the cheap because we've never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
There will be food trucks there. There are always food trucks behind the band trail for lunch. So you can bring – and it's a you know, it's out at the Golden Gate Park band trail. So it is basically out there open to the public. So you can bring your kids – there's plenty of room for them to run around. You don't have to follow them. You could be up there swing dancing,
getting
some dessert, right? Your kids could be looking for the fairy doors and the trees, and you know, it'll be a wonderful little afternoon on October 12th. The swing dance lessons start at 11:30.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you are interested in supporting the band, I would highly recommend you go to GoldenGateParkBand.org.
Okay.
And right there you will see dancing and dessert in the menu. Click on that and donate. We have to have a list of people. This is city stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have a list of people who have donated ahead of time who I can give a wristband to who will be allowed into the dessert area. So there are two requirements for that. One is that you must bring a dessert because it is potluck.
Mm-hmm.
But two is you have to sort of donate ahead of time so I know who you are.
Sure.
And so the city is happy. And
that would all happen on the website.
Right.
Okay.
And that will all happen on the website. And
which is what again?
Golden Gate Park Band.
Okay.
.org.
Okay.
O-R-G.
All right.
Yeah.
So you said jump blues. So what might we hear when we show up?
Oh, I'm still putting the music together.
Uh-huh.
We're gonna read it, of course.
Okay. Sure.
So you know, probably a little Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, maybe some. A friend of mine gave me his arrangement of "It Ain't Necessarily So," and I made it not vocal, so it doesn't need a vocalist.
Sure.
So you know, we're gonna put stuff together like that, and it'll be a small group, just six of us, but we all come from the band, so we're all in the park band. But what you hear on Sundays is not this. On our regular season, it is a concert band.
Okay.
So you're going to hear, think symphonic, but without strings. Classic band music. You will also hear all kinds of music from cultures that are relevant to the city. We have been labeled the soul of the city by the heritage, the business heritage group in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
They called us the soul of the city, and we're kind of leaning into that because we have been here since 1882.
Wow!
And one of the cool things that we do is every season we have what we call our partner programs, where we partner with cultural organizations in the city, and all the way, you know, for decades we've been doing this. So there's been, you know, a day of Irish music and dancing. There's been Italian music and dancing, German music and dancing way back when I looked back in the archives. This season we had Hungarian Day. We've had a Ukrainian Day for the past 33 years, I think.
Wow.
We do a Ukrainian Day every season. We had our Irish Day. Our conductor, Dr. Herman Gonzalez, who is at home with COVID, get better, Herman. Um, he started doing a day of Mexican music, which has been a lot of fun because they have a great band tradition in Mexico. And so we've been getting a lot of new music through that. We also have a Spanish day where we had this flamenco troupe with us.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, it's just every year, if you just go to goldengateparkband.org, you will see our calendar. Right now it's the year, the season that just finished, but you can see what we did this year and know that that's coming. And we usually start in late April and go to the first Sunday in October. But this year's calendar was a little different.
So we're out of time. So once more for our listening audience, when and what time for the music?
All right. October 12th, we start our swing dance lesson at 11:30. And then at noon, you're going to get an hour of some solid swing and jump blues to get you all worked up and needing a dessert, because at 1 o'clock is the dessert potluck. That happens on October 12th, coming up on Sunday. If you just go to goldengateparkband.org, there's a link to the dancing and dessert fundraiser right there. It'll tell you everything you need to know. You can also keep that bookmarked so you can see our seasons coming up next year.
Excellent. Well, Eric Wayne, Bruce Wayne's younger brother, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, people of Earth, music this Sunday. Yay. He mentioned It Ain't Necessarily So. I'm playing Eddie Chambly's It Ain't Necessarily Blues. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.